The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. There we go. Yeah. Easier said than done.
Yeah, come on, get with it.
My name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we're here with our guest.
Ray Help.
We are goofy.
It's like a sad comedy routine.
And that was Jackson Brown.
Pretty bad.
Jackson Brown, my redneck friend. I don't know why we picked that song. It just seemed funny. Like 6 years ago. Had I known it was going to play for this long, I think, I don't know, I guess we should have thought about it more. But we like it. Anyway, all right, today we've got a big, big topic. We actually posted the list of what we're going to talk about today, which is always dangerous because, well, most of the time we have this gigantic list and then, you know,
we
barely scratch the surface and then we got to do it all again. Another really super serious topic where you're probably going to get mad. Going to try to have as much fun as possible because it's about fire. And Lord knows it's a treasure trove of musical joy for Bob. There's like tons of fire music, right?
No shortage of that.
That's kind of what I thought.
and we've all got to experience the aftermath of the fire here in what, the last 2-3 weeks?
Oh my gosh.
It's like...
Well, it's the during math. I mean, it's not gone yet.
No.
It's and still
everybody,
happening.
Everybody out there has their own opinion of this, too.
That's true. So,
just
all right.
It's a smoky day every day, it seems like.
So here on the West Coast, we're having a lot of fire. Those of you in the rest of the universe, you hear about it, you see it on the news, but you might not know all of the things that surround that. So I guess I should tell you, we air live every Sunday from noon to 2 here on the West Coast. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. During that time, there's a chat window open, and so you can talk back and forth with us. On Mondays, we air in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore on WNJC 1360, and that's Mondays from 1 to 3. We're now airing both hours in Philadelphia. So, in deference to our folks in Philadelphia who are thinking, we don't care about your fires out there, I mean, okay, be politically incorrect to say that out loud, but they're thinking it. I can hear them thinking it, like, so who cares?
We don't live there.
You idiots. Yeah. Living in California. Okay, so why do you care about the topic if you don't live here and you don't have to breathe it? Because you get to pay for it.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Yeah, we thank you very much.
We're going to talk about the cost of this because it's driven by policy. We've got some serious policy problems, and your guys are voting on policy that affects us that you get stuck paying for. I mean, nobody gets away from anybody on this. Nobody gets out free. All Americans are losing national treasure. So all the things that you see that are public land that you think are set aside for you and your kids to go on vacation to see, you know, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Banff, I don't care where you go. If we burn it all up, you can come. You might as well just, like, look at pictures of the moon because that's what a lot of it looks like. You're going to pay the cost in your wood products. I don't care where you live. You use toilet paper, you know, you make furniture, you got houses, you've got all sorts of things that are wood products and byproduct, and that's burning up too. So as we just burn that up, you get to pay more for what's left. And I guess...
But it's not only a public land issue, though.
Of course, and a lot of it's private land, too.
If you live near a forest or if you have land adjacent to a public land...
It's a super personal issue.
Well, try and buy insurance on your property to protect your resource.
You're right.
You know, you're living
right.
With a
It's like
real,
living in a floodplain.
That's right.
Just different kind of flood.
Yeah.
As Ray brought up, the last little bullet point we added to this show was out here in the West, we're tired of breathing your green dream. Your green ecologies.
It's going up in smoke for sure.
It's screwing up our lungs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I thought I was sick yesterday. I thought I was getting sick. And I think it was just the smoke.
Yeah.
The day before, I mean, everybody's eyes are burning, and God forbid you live right next to it. For one, your place is burning up. Mm-hmm. But these guys are all worried about air pollution.
Yeah.
Well, if you think it looks good in China, you ought to come out here.
Yeah.
Same deal.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're not supposed to breathe that stuff in L.A. from the old smog from the 60s and 70s. this is many times worse.
Yeah, they didn't ever see smog like this. This is a whole new... And it's a big particulate.
It is.
I mean, it isn't... Like, people with allergies have a problem. Everybody's got allergies when this rolls in. And it's funny, you know, you go outside and it's like, you kind of taste it a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it's thick. Yeah. Well, you sent me that picture last week. If you didn't know what time of year it was, it looked like a kind of a cold, foggy day over Lake Whiskey
Lake
Town.
Anything.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a smoke layer laying down. You couldn't even see across the water, and it was completely smoked in.
Well, I drove up to Whiskey Town, Weaverville, up through Whiskey Town, and it's you're right in all the mountains. And normally you drive into Weaverville and you're surrounded by mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, might as well have been in Texas.
Sure.
It looked like, I mean, it was just a street. That's all you could see, was just a street. So a big factor of this is we're causing this ourselves.
Yeah, and I don't want to diminish the fact that fires ever present.
Things happen.
In our ecosystems. They have been forever.
Sure.
But what I hope we can talk about a little bit today is what's different today than how this functioned for, well, without our intervention. How's that?
Yeah, without us helping.
Yeah, without
us please
helping.
Stop helping.
Yeah, if we look back, you know, in fire history, you know, fires were of the magnitude we have today were infrequent. You know, we look at the fire history and million acre fires, excuse me, were pretty rare in every 300-400 years. But what we're seeing now is half million acre fires with recurring severity and recurring frequency every few years. And there's a lot of reasons for that, a lot of science around that. You know, years ago, the bulk of those very large fires were precipitated by normally a period of drought, which is what we're experiencing out here. The drought's not unusual. It's been there forever. But what's uniquely different is back then, lightning fires didn't usually start these large fires like we see today, because the fuels were very different. The bulk of the fires we saw starting back there were largely industrial in nature, man-made, you know, started by man, man's activities, and they got very big.
Well, remember we were kids? Hmm? That was always, you know.
I try to forget that part.
Smoking.
That's
okay. So, that was fun when I was a kid.
That was terrible.
Well, I didn't say we were good kids. I just said it was fun. It was fun for us. But, it was always people. That's all you ever heard about was a campfire, you know, somebody's campfire, that kind of thing.
Yeah. There were a few.
Did we have arsonists back then? Were we just Were we just clueless about arsonists?
Oh, we did.
Bill's an arsonist. What am I thinking?
Well, when I was a kid,
tried. tried my hand at it.
As a small child, Bill.
We look at, on the West Coast, the Tillamook Fire, that was largely from about Alsea, Oregon, all the way up to almost Astoria. Along the coastal range. That fire began as an industrial accident from logging operation, actually, in that area. And then it was encouraged by a couple of arsonists a few days later.
Oh, they piled on?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, you don't really have these big fires in the East.
No.
In other places. The trees are, it's just different.
Well, the landscape's broken up. You know, there's lots of cities.
Yeah.
There's lots of highways and lots of different kinds of vegetation.
And they have a lot more moisture.
Yeah, you don't have the continuous vegetation that you do out here on the West Coast.
And we didn't either, did we?
Naturally,
we didn't have this.
It was different.
We had meadows and things like that.
Well, if you look at Eric Knapp's research that's going back in the Sierras and reestablishing what Duncan Dunning did back in the 1930s, we see that those historic conditions in the Sierra and in Northern California had about 25% openness, and it wasn't all in one place. You know, it was patches here and there, and large trees with very little underbrush in it because there were frequent small fires that kept most of that beet down. But now what we've done is...
Well, we did a lot of grazing, too.
Well, we did a lot of grazing, and let's face it, we were coming off of 8,000 years of Native American burning, and then settler burning followed that for about a 100-year period.
Oh. And then we just pulled the plug on everything.
Yeah, my great former agency stopped that. 1934... the U.S. Forest Service, because it was put to protect the resource in place, issued a letter that demanded that all of the range burning and forest burning stop because they were burning up some trees. And what that precipitated was a dramatic increase in growth.
Then we had tree hugging.
Well, we had a lot more before that, too. We started industrial fire operations right after World War II, when things okay. started to become effective. And then, you know, we were managing forests like we should have to kind of mimic natural disasters or natural maintenance structures, actually, with fire in the forest. And we did that up until about, I'd say probably about 1985, 88. Doing a pretty good job of that.
Magic the Clintons.
Yeah, here we go. Then the timber war started on the West Coast. And the litigation started, and pretty much all of the industry-related stuff in the forest stopped. And what that did is it predisposed our forest from the standpoint that we stopped managing right at the time when we really needed to manage second-growth timber, the small stuff. Which burns really nice.
Oh, yeah.
Because prior to that period, the old growth piece, we're converting everything to second growth in the forest so that we could do high production on that and retool all the mills. But all of a sudden, that quit. So that predisposed the whole landscape at that point in time to these fires. And then couple that with a change in climate coming out of a 100-year wet cycle where you're artificially more dense than you should be.
Yep.
And... perfect recipe for what we have
today. A
little
dryness roll in and everybody stand back. And
the other thing most people forget about, too, is early in my career, back in the 70s, with the number of loggers and woods crews that were in the forest, they were on top of a fire long before the agency got there.
That's true. We had people there.
Yeah, that's not there anymore. So the response time is, instead of 30 minutes, you're talking 3-4 hours sometimes.
Yeah, we've gotten rid of a lot of those roads and caused people not to be out there.
Taking the equipment and the people out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because a lot of that same equipment that's out there harvesting timber is used to fight fire.
Same thing.
Yep, same stuff.
Yeah.
And people who know the area well.
That's right.
Got to take a quick break here. We're going to come back. We're chatting with Ray Haupt this morning. He'll give you a little bit of his bio when we come back. Thank our advertisers. Thank Bob. Give you time to get on the site. There's a ton of information on there, by the way. WeThePeopleRadio.us. That silence brought to you by... Oh, no. Killing my segue, Bob.
Okay, this priest walks into a bar.
Okay, a match walks into the forest.
Yeah, it would be easier to find that gold if you had to navigate all those darn trees. Just burn them down.
Just burn them all down.
Burn them all down.
Yeah, we got a little fire on our mountain out here. This topic we set up kind of a long time ago. I guess it was. We didn't have to be clairvoyant to know that it might be fire season.
Might reoccur.
Yeah, we might be having a fire.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. Let me flip back here. So you spent. Rahab spent 33 years in the Forest Service.
Yeah, and what's not on that resume is my involvement with fire.
Yeah. You're now a county supervisor.
I am.
In the area where you were a district ranger.
Correct.
So, okay, just to give people a little. And I also, did I do it? Yes, I did. I clicked the previous show. You've got a little link on there from July 12th. So if you want to hear the, I don't know if it was really the first half. What were we talking about back then? Something.
Fire.
No, but we wanted to. We were like, it's a different show.
No, we were talking about the...
I think we were just talking about forest stuff.
Just forest policy and Endangered Species Act and those
kinds
of things.
That's right.
Yeah. We might get to some of that again today.
Because you know? it's all part and parcel of the same issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so now what were you doing with fire when you were in the Forest Service?
Well, I spent the bulk of my career in, as a forester, but as a forester with an agency like that, it's the best of both worlds. In private industry, you're doing forestry, and that's it.
And what does that mean? Like, for people who live in a city, when somebody says, I'm a forester, they're like, no.
Yeah, well, you
know. It brings nothing to mind.
It's the one position.
The Subaru.
Exactly.
Yeah, really. It's the one position for land management agencies that is professionally taught in all of the science disciplines and not just a narrow field like wildlife biology or hydrology or something like that. We have, you know, we do focus a lot of study in the science of growing trees, basically, which has a lot of economics, a lot of investment, business principles associated with that. But then we're the ones that have to try and blend all of these, you know, this specialist wants that and that specialist wants this, and we kind of have to sit there and try and pull this together so that one science doesn't outstep another.
Winds up being patchwork quilt.
Yeah, and do something that isn't within the bounds of what the vegetation and the landscape can do.
Oh. Yeah, so no imaginary application like some of these restoration plans. Let's return it to a time and place that it never was.
Well, let's pick one.
Exactly.
Which one would you pick?
Let's pick what we like the most and retool it all.
Right. Or let's just ignore it all and hope it doesn't go sideways on you.
Yeah, it's not working out very well either.
But what I was going to say is that beyond being a forester, the other part that I did was I chose to be involved in fire. So I did. I've participated in or written and managed prescriptions for over 1 million acres of prescribed fire.
That's if we're going to burn it on purpose.
Yeah.
Not to decimate it, but to kind of clean up the undergrowth.
Just clean it up. Yeah.
I was on a fire team myself for about 5 years, permanently on a team here in California, and I did logistics work, and I did I was a division soup in operations. And local stuff got up to an incident commander type three. Basically, so I have real in-depth knowledge. And later on in my career, when all of us get old and look at those mountains and say, young man's sport or young woman's sport, I worked directly for the regional office in Vallejo for the Forest Service doing policy interpretation and policy implementation on a team directly related to fire.
And so, you know, that, I guess that leads us to kind of the bigger question, because I know different states have different things, but out here we have CAL FIRE, and then we also have the Forest Service that has firefighting capability.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on the experience people have had or who they know or, you know, the things they've been told, people think, well, we should just have one. We should just let CAL FIRE fight all the fires, and, you know, what's the Forest Service, they're a bunch of knuckleheads.
Yeah.
But they're really different.
Very different. Different laws, different missions. CAL FIRE's primary role is protection of life and property on private land.
I mean, is that the same? Do most states have a state fire agency? Is that pretty common?
Most do, except for some of the East Coast where I've worked, they're less fire-oriented and more management-oriented.
The state agency?
The state agency.
So the state would be more trained in protection of structures and property, whereas Forest Service is more...
Yeah, Forest Service is actually forbidden to do structure protection unless it's an immediate threat that you cannot get someone else to do. So
got a cabin out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and their primary role is fire behavior in the upland and how to modify that and suppress that. And that's very different. The other different major difference between the two is when the public land agencies are fighting fire, they have to ascribe to all of that Endangered Species Act, all the rest of that layer of bureaucracy associated with
that. But your state fire agencies, I mean, you're not going to run to a town that's, you know, the fire's burning towards a town.
No.
You don't have to sit around and figure out what endangered species are there.
No. Now they will, when they're on public land, they do the same thing. Or if there's something listed on state land that they know about, that they have protocols that they have to follow as well. But it's not their they're not left with having to clean that up afterwards.
Oh.
Okay. They don't live with the action.
Okay.
So there's a different mindset.
The other thing too is with, you know, all these people think these wilderness areas are wonderful.
Yeah.
And magical, et cetera, et cetera. So they designate something a wilderness area, and again, people who maybe don't have to deal with that on the ground think that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
What is it when you turn public land into a wilderness area? You can't build roads there.
True.
You can't use any machinery there.
Except in emergency situations, but there's really limitations on it. A lot
and so then if there's a fire that burns from regular Forest Service land, say, onto a wilderness area, what happens? Or doesn't happen?
Well,
everybody gets on their Birkenstocks
depends.
And their hemp shirts?
I mean, I'll tell you, it's fairly agency-specific. Depends on whether you're asking that question of the Park Service, which takes the most liberal interpretation of wilderness, or if you talk to the Forest Service, which takes the more conservative.
And Cal Fire wouldn't fight on wilderness.
They wouldn't be there anyway.
They wouldn't go there.
Hard to get an engine in wilderness.
Right.
You know, they may support with a crew, you know, a CDC crew or something like that, but typically not, unless it's an aerial
support. I was going to say, what about aerial support?
Yeah, they will.
They will fight it?
They will do that if it's a unified command situation where they're engaged. But that doesn't happen very often unless you have a wilderness boundary bump right up against a big private property boundary or something like that.
Hmm. So if you have to fight fire on a wilderness area, what are your tools?
Shovel? Well, that's where you start. And then depending on the fire itself, you try and make the most of natural barriers and things like that aid in the suppression, because the prevailing thought in wilderness is whatever action you take in suppression is much longer lasting than the fire itself on the land.
Okay. Is that true?
It is true if we hadn't altered the landscape to begin with.
Yeah, because I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah. Some of it is so loaded up that...
Yeah, yeah, if you don't stop it, it'll...
The wilderness purist would say... we should have never suppressed fire to begin with in wilderness, and we wouldn't have the situation we have right now. And I tend to believe that a little bit, with some reason. Often when you set something aside or you do something, there's always an unintended consequence.
Sure.
I really don't think...
Overhelping?
Yeah. In 1965, I don't think Congress thought that through clearly about what to do with fire. Because the wilderness law itself says natural processes will be allowed to dominate.
Mm.
Okay? So it's hard then...
Could be fire.
Fire is, in the West, is one of the most predominant natural processes.
Yeah, most of the fires that we're looking at now are all lightning fires. However, what if you have a arson fire in a wilderness area? Is that going to be considered a natural process?
No, they're suppressed instantly.
Okay.
Yeah. By policy. Now the problem with the lightning fires is from 1965 to about the early 2000s, they were all suppressed as well. So it allowed that landscape to get to the even worse condition than the managed landscape outside of it. And so I would advocate at this point, without putting fire back in from a prescribed fire standpoint, to control vegetation and put it and try and reset that clock. You're dealing with an anomaly that didn't exist prior to the wilderness designation.
But can you really reintroduce fire into a large area like that. I mean, that some of those wilderness areas are thousands and thousands and thousands of acres. You can't go in there and burn the whole thing, can you?
No. You know, if you'd asked me that question in 1930, I'd have said no big deal.
Right.
Because it wasn't all loaded up.
No, it wasn't all loaded up. The Frank Church Wilderness up in, I think it's Montana, Idaho, the largest wilderness in the system, is often used as the example of what natural fire can do in the wilderness, because it really was never suppressed.
Right.
And it's so large and there's nothing around it to speak of. The fire just kind of does its thing.
So it runs through, burns up the grass and some of the lower little stuff, but it doesn't just leave it.
No. No, and then when you try and bring that methodology of that mindset to the San Bernardino that has a wilderness with a city limit almost adjacent to the wilderness, that just doesn't work because of the public safety threats.
Well, now, what about like Yosemite when it caught on fire? It was a lot of folks were saying that that was due to poor management, there was a lot of fuels built up in Yosemite.
Yeah,
it burned it to the ground.
Yeah, there are, and you know, the key with all of, to me, I was a real expert in wilderness managed fire.
Really?
Okay? Yes. And the key to all that is when to burn and when not, and the
like time of year, amount of growth,
fuels condition, the moisture in the fuels, the prediction of weather, all of those things. Where did it start on the slope? Where is it in proximity to a town? Where is this wilderness? Because they all are different, and their fire behavior is all different, and so is the meteorology that affects those fires. So I guess what I'm saying is, prior to me ever doing any of that personally as a line officer for the Forest Service, I actually spent about 5 years with really highly technical teams gaming that out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it wasn't something you just kind of willy nilly, you know, stumble into.
Let's go light it and see where it goes.
And at the time,
that seemed to be a process here recently that went a couple of times. Like,
yeah. And that's kind of what I'm getting at.
You know, DLM, their controlled burn on like 40 mile an hour wind day when it's 105.
First one I did was in 2006 in the Marble Mountains, and that was a 6 month event.
Really?
Yeah, 6 months, and. Wasn't all that expensive, but I can tell you, I had a team of computer geeks working 24/7 doing predictive services on fire behavior and weather and you know, risk assessment and all those things coming up to be able to predict with some kind of, you know, better than a guess kind of certainty.
Like, are you okay to leave it run?
Yeah, or do we take an action here versus over here, and that kind of thing to herd it around?
Turn it.
Yeah, and that kind of thing. But at that time, I also was able to assemble a national team that, like, there were a handful of people that could actually do this in the nation. So for the agency to go where it's gone today, I believe is irresponsible. It's not a product of waking up one morning and we'll go, hey, we're just going to do this policy. I think it's a symptom of not being able to do things.
Sure, they get sued for everything.
Yeah,
we're gonna cut. I mean, even up where you are, what, 4% of a massive burn area?
Yeah, 4%.
Just to harvest the trees that are going to be dead or dying.
Yep.
And so that they're usable.
Impossible to get through the regulatory structure and then get through the courts on top of that.
Can't do it.
Yeah, it's nuts. But what I guess what I'm saying is that to then go ahead and do that one thing, because that was the only thing that was going on nationally at the time. To take that and say we're going to do that anywhere in the nation on multiple forests at the same time, I don't think is well thought out.
Yeah. Well, and yet we can't just sit there and, you know, Not do anything.
Yeah. So you know. So what do you do? At this point, you have to aggressively attack every fire,
mm-hmm.
especially with the weather conditions. And 2006 were not the weather conditions we're having right now.
True.
So
it's gotten really, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Dry. And you know, I would never contemplate that mm-hmm. today in this weather. excuse me.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
In the drought cycle that we're in, so. I guess what I'm getting at, so you have to attack aggressively everything, put it out, and then...
Which is not manageable.
And then maybe have this discussion again in 5 years when we have El Ninos and things back in place when this drought subsides, kind of a thing. The statistics are that if they get on a fire within the first 24 hours, they have there's about a 98% chance of extinguishing that fire. It's only the 2% that get to the fires that are problematic like this if there was aggressive initial attack.
No kidding.
Yeah. But you have to temper that with a standpoint, and we'll get into the fire response mechanisms here in a bit and the structure.
Speaking of the drought.
But yeah, in my throat.
Let's take a quick break. Right. We'll let Ray handle the drought over there.
Right.
He's having his own personal climate change. I thought that was just girls. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, yeah, I worked in menopause. That's pretty good, huh?
That's good.
Oh, my gosh. We'll be right back.
You'll always be a fire I can't put out. I don't know how to handle the dream you left behind. It's like a lighted candle burning up my mind. At least I'm happy. What love's all about. You'll always be a fire I can't put out.
Inappropriate that we laugh at these things, but we can't help it.
I love that song.
We are who we are.
Yeah.
We're just inappropriate. Oh my gosh. So, okay, on the break. I had written 25% on my notebook, but but I didn't finish my note.
Okay.
So I was asking Ray, why did I write that down? So we had talked at the very beginning about 25% of the land basically didn't have trees on it or had new trees.
Correct.
And that moved around. It wasn't the same 25%.
Right.
Just kept shifting around. But approximately at any given time, you could take a bird's eye view and you'd get 25% of our forested land that was open.
And it changes with elevation. But that's,
sure.
You know, those are general statements.
Yeah. Okay, so what did it do to fire?
Well, what it did to fire is it forced the fire to drop to the ground. You know, because the fire behavior, you look at fire behavior, you have to have fuels in continuity. For the fire behavior to be unchanging. And what you're always looking for is some modification of fire behavior to be able to suppress it.
So when it dropped to the ground...
When it dropped to the ground, you could actually get a tool on it versus running through the ground, through the crowns
right.
Above your head, which is kind of what's going on right now because we have this giant clone of the same age class across the entire landscape. So we were talking about management, you know, the prevailing thought in forestry in the generation that was trained before me was that we need to maximize growth on every acre and get the most amount of boards per acre produced for the American public. And that was the goal of forestry. That is the definition, actually, still of industrialized forestry. That's practiced mainly on flat ground in the southeast part of the U.S.
And that works depending on your terrain and your goal and
depends
how you're
going to
do it.
Yeah.
It's a renewable resource.
It's a maximization of the growing potential of every acre.
And as long as you follow through with the harvest plan, that's
correct.
Fine. But when you stop the harvest plan,
correct.
Now you've got a mess.
Because you suppress the fire,
and at
stop
that point,
the harvest.
What you're doing is you're looking at an investment. An investment that you enter into in year zero, and you carry that interest forward through at least 60 years. And on public lands, it's 120 for a rotation before it's cut. So getting away from that, what we as foresters, and I won't say we because I was trained after that to recognize natural processes and ecosystems and those kinds of things. But what we did is we took the old growth off of the scattered parcels, so to speak, the other 75% that was scattered here and about. And then on the 25% that had young stuff on it or brush, we converted all that to plantations. And we normalized, if you will, the same age class across the entire landscape.
So everything's the same size.
Same size, same fire behavior.
So you get a good wind.
You get a good wind.
You get to burn it all down all at the same time.
In a drought, and you're in an overcrowded condition already, you have tremendous potential for large fire growth.
Mm-hmm.
And with that extra production on the ground, you have more trees on the ground, fewer meadows. I remember you had told me a long time ago to consider too what happens when it snows.
Sure.
You don't have any snowpack.
Yeah,
it doesn't hit the ground.
Look at Roger Bales and the work that he's doing, Dr. Bales from UC Merced, and we're doing some of this up in the Klamath Mountains. You'll see that the forests that we've studied so far from 1930s on are four times the density that they were today than what they were historically in the 30s. And across every acre, which has eliminated basically the ability to pack snow.
Because it never gets to the ground.
Because it never gets to the ground. In most ecosystems at the higher elevations where the snow falls, if snow intercepts a canopy, you lose about 70% of it directly back into the atmosphere, the moisture. Just hangs up and melts and evaporates right back. Then you have the additional transpiration from the trees themselves from being too dense and stressed. And all of a sudden, guess what? You have really low flows in your streams. I mean, I hate to
the,
you know
the trees
that term.
Need
this
the
isn't
water.
This
yeah.
isn't rocket science. It
no,
really isn't, but it is science.
Mm-hmm.
And we have severely dysfunctional hydrologic systems because of how the landscape's been altered from historic.
So then you get a seasonal drought like we've been having.
It sets up the whole system then for Mother Nature to reset itself. And that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can do that with forest management and control the effect, or we can live with Mother Nature's
fury. We can just
fury.
Roll the dice like we're doing now.
Yeah. And, the big difference is in forestry, we practice recovering that site. I'm not going to talk about clear cuts, but I'm talking about thinnings. When we do a thinning, we want that forest to come back to a similar state within 20 years. After it's
that's the plan.
That's the plan. That's the not a goal, but that is the design of modern silvicultural prescriptions. And for Mother Nature to do it, and you have stand replacing fire like we have today, we're talking 300-400 years.
Because it's burned so hot and so deep,
and you've sterilized the soil in the process. So everybody says, well, it's natural. Yeah, it is. So are volcanic eruptions, glaciers. Depends what you want to live with.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
But we have somebody in the chat that brought up a good point. The advertising on television says, only you can prevent forest fires.
Yeah.
And that 90% of wildfires are human caused. Do you agree with that statement?
Depends where you are. If you're around an urban area, that's probably the case. And that's really bastardized, probably isn't the term, but swayed. The statistic is swayed from a national perspective because of the high incident of fires that are started back east by man. That is, if you're not along the East Coast, Florida, Alabama, Texas, where they get a lot of lightning, it is man that starts most of the fires.
Right. So it's a real regional.
It is regional. And that's what I'm going to say about all of our discussion here. You know, you can't take, you know, everybody has a perception of fire, but even me, I'm talking about one, but I can tell you that if you asked me these same questions and I were sitting in Spokane, my answers will be different, because fire is different, as are the trees and the systems that live with it.
Oh, okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, and same too with the terrain.
Right.
I mean, you see, that's a huge factor in a lot of these places.
And just here, fire behavior, say west of I-5, after you go north of Redding, the fire behavior is driven by three things, basically. But primarily, any fire is driven by topography and fuel continuity. Mm-hmm. And then it's exacerbated by moisture conditions associated with drought or other weather things that go on. You go to the east side of Interstate 5 as you go north and east of the Cascades, the driving force is wind. And because wind has to drive the fire, because the fuel continuity isn't as tight as it is in the more moisture-laden forests west of Interstate 5.
Right. I heard the other day that the big fire they have over in Lake County, they said they haven't had a fire over there in like 40 years, and that's one of the reasons it's so hot and moving so fast, is there's just tons of and real tall fuel on the ground.
Well, we can talk about fire reentry. You'll hear that fire reentry interval.
Mm-hmm. So it's been suppressed for a long period of time?
Yeah, suppressed for a long period of time. When you get to missing 4 and 5 fire departures around here, you have some pretty conflagration kind of conditions. And what I'm saying is that in the science in north of Redding is about every 15 years, fire will visit an acre.
Unless you're in Happy Valley.
Yeah. Well, but see, you're in a different fire regime there.
Okay.
You're in a 5-year fire That's frequency.
5-minute fire frequency.
Well,
historically, that was 5 years. But what I'm saying is, and this isn't too hard to figure out, all you have to do is study the brush. And west of Interstate 5, you're going north, Manzanita and the other brush species start building dead material in their crown at about 12 years. And when you get to 15, it'll start carrying a fire again.
Oh, okay.
So that's why the... And then all you're waiting for is lightning. And so that's why it's 15 to 20 years.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. On that note, see, there's a lot of this that actually does. It's not really the crapshoot that we think it is. You know, where you just sit around and go, "Oh, gee, I hope we don't get lightning." I mean, some of this.
Well, there are a lot of unknowns. I mean, why don't we have big fires this year on the Klamath like we had last year? Well, what I've been doing is I've been studying the energy release components and the 10-year or the 10-hour fuels, 100-hour fuels, and 1,000-hour fuels. They're not where they were last year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier to suppress a fire. And without the occurrence of fire, you're just not going to get them.
Nice. Well, you guys get a break then. What a pleasant change.
Yeah.
What a pleasant change for you.
Yeah, we'll hold our breath.
Exactly. All right. We're going to talk about a little fire here in a minute. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Not about you, Bill.
when I did start the fire.
I know, that's why I said this song is not about you.
No.
This is for Ray and Bob and I, not you.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Tons of information on today's page. Tons. Okay. So in the break, we were talking. See, we have a lot of fun on the break, actually. Then we have to tell you what we talked about. We always say that.
We have to zip our lips on the break.
On the break, we talked about
this. That's where Aaron gets to put me back on track.
That's right. Where that's where I'm like, okay, what about this? What about that? All right, so you were saying that on flatland we should have fire every...
Well, down here...
Well, in real life you would
down
normally.
Here around Redding, you know, the fire return interval was 1 to 5 years.
Because the grass
would grow up.
We have digger pine, we have, you know...
Yeah, you know, digger pine itself will not regenerate even in the presence of grass.
Really?
So it's completely intolerant to any shade at all. So when you start seeing brush around the lower lands here in the presence of digger pine and or ghost pine, whatever you want to call it these days, you've got something that's severely departed from normal fire interval.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So it would normally just whip through every few years, not be that big of a deal. Wouldn't burn the trees down, I guess, is my...
No. No,
the thing people
just,
need to know.
Grass-driven, grass fires, very fast-moving, very low heat residency, so to speak. It doesn't take very long to move through.
Doesn't burn your whole town down.
No, just, it's a flash, you know. Play that song, too.
Yeah. Off it goes.
Yeah.
And then in the higher elevations with more, in the more mountainous.
Yeah, and once you start up off the valley floor here, and I'm thinking when you start north and you start to hit where the dam is, then you'd have brush.
Sure.
You know, because that's a transition zone between the grassland down here in the valley and then to the forested zone above, and it's a moisture gradient, basically, and temperature gradient.
Okay, and you were talking about John Muir, too. That was an interesting little piece.
Yeah, you know, I was reading some historic stuff recently, and John Muir was lamenting about how beautiful it was in the Sierra, being able to ride through the Sierra unobstructed by trees and see for miles on horseback.
And where can you do that now? Nowhere.
Maybe in the rocks above Lake Tahoe.
So
there's some terrain outside, out near Siskiyou County that...
A quarter of a billion acres,
yeah,
actually.
It's
got pretty good viewing.
Yeah, you got a lot of good views up
there.
Yeah,
great stuff.
Nice. All right, so in our last minute and a half of this hour,
uh-huh.
All right, what are we going to talk about next hour? Because, we had a really long list.
Yeah.
We have this really super long list. Actually, we're like halfway through it.
Let's wrap this ecology stuff and move into more of the fire
the politics.
The fire industrial machine kind of thing. To wrap the fire ecology and that kind of thing, one thing that we haven't discussed is what is the difference with the fire today versus the fire even of my youth 40 years ago? The difference is that historically fires moving through the northern mountains of California had about, which mimics the Sierra, 25% high severity fire.
Oh.
Or actually less. Around 20. But it was really important where it occurred. It occurred in the upper third of the slope. Now we're having stand replacing fire, which is high severity fire, at any elevation. That's very uncharacteristic of the natural.
So we've like messed up the way it should normally
that's
work.
A management
greatly
problem.
Altered the way fire behavior and our ecosystems function.
And we haven't talked about the money. When we come back, we're talking about money because this is the part where your wallet cries out for help.
Yeah.
WeThePeopleRadio.us. Be right back.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome back to We the People Radio. You're joining Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
And Ray Howe.
Our guest Ray Hupp is in the studio. How fun is that?
Wow.
We don't have to say, can you hear us?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you on a cell phone?
Oh, we lost him. His connection's bad.
Let me find the mute button.
I know. We should probably just make crackling noises just so people
don't, in the background,
don't feel confused. No, it's fun. It's fun when you're actually here. So we're talking about fire today, and tons of information on the website, wethepeopleradio.us. And this show actually airs live Sundays from noon to 2. It airs recorded in Philadelphia, and that's on the West Coast. And on the East Coast, Mondays from 1 to 3 in Philadelphia and New Jersey. All that information's on here. So if you'd like to talk to us about guests, topics, sponsoring, all that jazz, our phone numbers, emails, everything, wethepeopleradio.us. It's all there for you. So, okay. Today, we're talking about fire, and for those of you who live in a city or who live in an area that doesn't deal with giant wildland fires, you're paying for it, for starters. Your public land is burning up, your national parks and all that stuff. You know, you're going to wind up with nothing at the rate we're going. And wood products, cost is going to go skyrocketing. It is a renewable resource that we're completely wasting, and the rest of us are having to breathe it in, which we're not excited about.
Yeah, that's one thing.
So that's
I've never
why this
understood.
Is an everybody topic.
Yeah, the policy of not harvesting timber on Forest Service ground that's been burned. I mean, when are they going to change that?
It's not their policy. The Forest Service up in the Klamath tried. They've tried for a year.
Well, who's shutting that down?
Da, 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 da. The environmentalists.
Yeah, that's
they
insane.
They sue them because they think that the...
Or even the threat of suit, you know.
Sure.
Draws the process.
I mean, the millions and millions of dollars that just go to waste and they cry because they don't have any money and they can't shut those guys down. They could start shutting them down by stop paying them to sue them. I know that would be...
Yeah, Equal Access to Justice Act. We did that in the last show with you.
Yeah.
Get rid of that.
Yeah.
A totally different deal. But, the cost.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how much this costs us, because that's really everybody's problem.
Sure, and last time I was on with you, we had in the chat room people were wanting to know about, man, the fire industrial machine and all that kind of stuff. Well, there is big business around fighting fire, as everybody knows. If you've ever been around a big fire, you see lots of expensive equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Costs a lot of money to move crews around, train them.
Some of the equipment isn't even used. It's paid by the day to sit there.
Right. That's right, because in fire, it's just like a fire station. You know, you may have a fire going on someplace, but you still have equipment sitting around just in case.
Yeah, you can't deploy everything.
No.
You've got to have some reserve. Yeah.
The Forest Service doesn't own enough water trucks or bulldozers or anything, so they bring private equipment in to have it available, whether they use it or not.
Yeah.
And so
I don't really have a problem with that, though.
I would rather have private
industry support and maintain that equipment than have the government do it.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I think the government should own it all. However, for people who don't see this, they need to know how much it's not just, okay, we need an engine and let's run it out there. It could be hours away. So they've got to have it on site.
Sure.
And so I was talking to someone who said like 50% of the Forest Service budget now goes to fire. It's like 50%.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be managing our public lands.
Yeah, and every year.
But instead, they're managing them burning up.
And every year, Congress appropriates money to manage the land. And every year, this time of the year, in the last quarter of the fiscal year, the agencies can't go back to Congress for more money. Well, they can, but they're usually not successful in the last quarter of the fiscal. And as a result, the Office of Management and Budget makes them balance their budget. And to do so, they start taking all the money from all the other programs, the service programs that everybody enjoys, the camping, the fishing, the wildlife viewing, and even the prescribed fires and the fire fuels work.
Sure.
Taking all that to pour into the suppression effort to make it through to October 1st. And that's happened with regularity the last 10, 15 years.
See, and that's and up here in places that used to have logging and timber harvesting, that was an enterprise thing, put people to work, created lumber, all the different things that happened, and now that's been converted into a fire industry.
And if you think about it, how did we get here? Well, we got here with a mindset that was able to absorb that in the budget years ago. But where we are today is that formula that was put together back in the 60s or 70s, for the percent of budget that had to be set aside for fire is no longer valid because our conditions have changed.
Yeah. We've loaded it all up, and now we're either going to fix that quickly or burn it. Yeah. But I don't think we could fix it fast enough
to
turn that corner, even if we could.
And you have to understand how all this works. You know, it's not that the Forest Service has some kind of plan that they enact, although they do have plans that they enact. That's not what
sure.
I'm talking about. There's an entire national structure around emergencies. And it's managed out of Boise, Idaho, at the National Incident Command Center. And in that center, there's representatives from the military, all of the states, all of the federal agencies, and many of the state agencies as well. And they twice a day brief on what's going on nationally that may affect emergency resources, and they allocate and move things around. So your volunteer fire departments, your Office of Emergency Services engines, your CAL FIRE, your Oregon Department of Forestry, all of them are part of this mix of a giant chess game that's going on nationally.
And the big eye in the sky sits in Boise and kind of watches that.
That's right.
Interesting. Okay, hold that thought, because we have Billy Bob on the line who has a question or a comment for us.
So
we don't want to leave him stranded in there forever. Hey, how's it going?
No, I'm caught in the smoke. What are you guys
calling?
Hey, we're here.
Yeah. Hey, great show as usual, Aaron. I fought 2 years ago. I was up running bulldozer on the Bagley Fire up at a big bend up there. Steep, I mean, unbelievably steep ground.
Horribly rough ground.
Oh, my God. I mean, straight off, you could have rolled a donut clear to the river. So anyway, and then last year I was out there at that Ono or whatever it's called out there, and I watched more waste of money with CAL FIRE. I mean, up at the Bagley Fire, there was all these steep hills, and so when it burns over, it loosens all the humus underneath the rocks and stuff, so you get rock slides.
Yikes.
And there was this one section of road, probably 150 feet anyway, maybe 200 feet of rock slide, and they were burning hot rocks, probably 4 to 6 inch rock, little stuff, not any big ones, but, and they were smoking hot, right? And they had these six, CAL FIRE, pumpers come up the road. And they first got out, and they had their shovels, and there was six guys in each rig, and six of them, so that's 36 guys, and they started to clear the rocks, and then the superintendent says, no, jump back in, so everybody put their tools away, jump back in, and these six CAL FIRE brand new tires ran over the hot, burning rock. I stood there, and I just could not believe it.
How'd that work out?
Yeah, that's, you know, brand new rubber on those rigs, and they burn, drive over burning rocks. It would have taken them 15 minutes to clear that road, but no, that's too much work. So anyway, I've watched more money being wasted up on these fires, so don't tell me about the inadequacy of the state of California. All right, let you guys go. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
That was an interesting twist, because I usually get the opposite in my area.
It's usually CAL FIRE's the hero.
Yeah, CAL FIRE's the hero.
Forest Service
is thrown under the bus.
Oh, yeah, I hear a lot of CAL FIRE stories.
Well, you know, and everybody means well, and let's face it, you know, at the end of the day, when the place is burning up, it's not like we ever want to, you know, bash our firemen, because it's a hard job.
Well, you know, we were talking about the incident response piece.
Yeah.
And the incident command system is a paramilitary design. There's an incident commander, and that's what the incident commander is, directs all the operations. There's logistics that does the groundwork and the moving the troops around and getting things ready. There's a planning department that plans the attack for the next day. There's operations that's carrying it out. There's an air branch that's doing the Air Force piece. So the listeners out there, how many of you would point to a military operation and say, boy, I got 100% efficiency there in everything I see.
Exactly.
Right. Well, too, you have to realize that there are probably a lot of other circumstances involved in these incidents that the public's not aware of.
Sure.
And when
you see stuff like that, you clear the rock stones to drive them over.
Yeah, you don't really know all the details and all the facts, you know, but it is awful easy to jump to conclusions.
Well, and my point in all of this is
that it's all being run by humans.
That because of the lack of management, that can, scientifically is proven, can reduce the severity of fire, reduce the amount or the duration of these fires and the expenditures. By the American taxpayer not paying for it, by the way, because that it's paid for by the profit off of whatever harvest is done on those public lands. What the American public has chosen to do is say, no, we're going to invest it on the back end, you know, in the response.
We're just going to pay for fire.
Which is the most inefficient end with the highest impact.
And then you could literally salvage the budget with the salvage.
Yeah.
If, in fact, you could harvest that.
But we've chosen not to do
that
as well.
Yeah.
And we're not reforesting. So what we've done, you know, I've told many people this, you know, oh, you just want to cut timber. Well, okay, I'm a forester, but, I don't cut it with reckless abandon. You're right. I do want my industry to survive. I do want my industry to be healthy because I know that if my support structure goes down, so does the ability to stop what we're seeing on this landscape. There's no place to take it. When we had the fires in Southern California about 6-7 years ago, guess what they did with all the stuff around Lake Arrowhead? They hauled it out to the desert and burned it because there was no place to take that old growth timber that burned up there around Lake Arrowhead.
Oh, they had already
Lake
closed
Arrowhead.
All the mills.
That's right. They strangled all the mills
that's
out
right.
of business.
And they hauled it out to Bishop and burned it.
Yeah.
Super.
You know, yeah.
So all these people who would drive 5 miles to recycle a can are the same guys who...
Yeah.
You know, will burn up tons and tons and tons of timber. And it is a huge industry. You have to have it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old...
Why are we making it a primary industry?
Old enough like me to remember the old Quaker State commercial that was, pay me now or pay me later.
Oh, yeah.
Doing an oil change today versus saving an engine job.
Mm-hmm.
Same concept.
It is the exact same concept.
And you can't... what you said earlier was so spot on. You can't have 100% efficiency when you're in crisis mode.
No, and then add government to it.
And then, exactly. Yeah, crisis mode in the government
and
is
the problem solver is the
people's
government.
Disaster.
Now, I'll tell you know, all of this thing going on, too, a gentleman called in and said it's all, you know, resources sitting around or whatever. Okay, but what's going on behind the scenes as well as there are geographic area commands that are report to the National Command Center. There's one right here in Reading that controls all troop movements basically in the North State from all the agencies and everything, all the flying parts and bulldozers
and
everything.
And then they set up like the tents and stuff out on
the... Well, yeah, but what they're doing too is even though you may see that piece of equipment sitting there, it may be held there by the Reading office in case another something starts over in a particular other place where there's what we call drawdown, where all of the engines are already engaged in something else. So there has to be a backup. So that's, you're seeing that as well. And that's, the public doesn't understand that piece.
No, but when you see things that are silly, like, I mean, I remember last year in the fire, there were big cases of water and things like that that were all dumped in the landfill.
Yeah.
And people just freaked out.
So, yeah.
Which they should have.
Sure.
Freaked out.
That's waste.
But the bad part is there's not always a mechanism for that. You know, they're there to, they only have one gear forward.
Yeah.
There's no reverse.
No.
So when they go to take it apart, there's no way to do that efficiently.
And it's illegal to give that to the public.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's the part that we found out about was you can't give that away.
No,
it has to be destroyed.
No, Congress has forbidden that.
Yeah.
So it has to be trucked all the way back to where it came from, and hopefully you can get it there at a cost less than what you bought it for.
See, and there's stuff like that that just has to get fixed if we ever get to get over these gigantic things that we need. Those are the things that we need to get to.
Sure.
But it just I challenge
anybody that's ever been in business. If you've ever been in business, you have employees working for you. How many of you can guarantee me that you get 100% of performance out of every one of them?
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, we're human.
Yeah.
That's right.
Darn humans. Can't live with them. Can't live without them. Alrighty. We need to take a really fast break here.
Break?
Yeah. Because it's going like wildfire today. talking about fire, and the show's just burning by.
Yeah.
That's all I can think of are fire things. All right, wethepeopleradio.us. Find us online. Send us emails. Give us ideas, etc.
So many lies, you twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much of love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I let you love.
And we had my Give a Damn's Busted special request for Billy Bob. Just seemed to fit. I always play songs for the callers. So, all right, you're back with We the People Radio. We're talking to Ray Haupt this morning. We chatted with him about the July, let's see, we talked to him on July the 12th, actually, and that program is linked up. We did a lot of precursor to this, and then we realized we didn't have time to do fire. Yeah. And today we don't have time to do fire because it's going too fast.
Fire is the result of the July 12th.
Exactly. That's the
topic.
Yeah, if you don't take care of your resources, you burn them all up.
Yeah.
So what's the cost per day?
You know, we talked about the incident command system a little bit. And incident command teams, if you will, start at ICT-1, which is a Type 1 team, which is basically can handle about anything.
So that's the big one.
That's the big team.
Okay.
That's the big team. It's a national team. The highest qualifications for every member on that team, they're composed of about 55 people. Different areas, you know, their notoriety. They manage the logistical work for at 9/11 at both New York, at the Trade Center, and the logistical work at the Pentagon recovery after 9/11.
Interesting. And so, are they? How many of them are there?
In California, we have five right now, but
they could go anywhere.
They can go anywhere. And nationally, I don't know right now. I'd have to look at the.
And I guess I'm curious: do they live all over the place, or are these 55 people who live? Like, do they all meet at the incident?
Yes.
But the rest of the time, they just live all dispersed.
They're on rotation,
okay.
And they're on 14 days on, 2 days off if they're on assignment.
Hmm.
They can be extended to 21 days. When they do come off, they're mandatory down for 2 days, and then they come back on call. And when they're up for rotation, which means they're the next team to take an incident, they have a minimum hour callback, so to speak. So they have to be either near an airport or
I see what you're saying.
Ready to turn the key in the ignition when they get the call. And their response time is about 24 hours to get to wherever it is they're going. Now, people think when they see a Type 1 team on a Forest Service incident, it's Forest Service. Forest Service doesn't have any all Type 1 teams anymore.
They don't?
No. Huh. The bulk of the teams are what we used to call rainbow teams.
and now that's bad.
Yeah, I know.
Or good, I guess, depending on where
you're at. Depending on where you're at. But what it is it's a collection of agency experts, some of them retired, some of them working for another business or something like that. And what they do is they still fight fire. They may have started in the Forest Service, may have started BLM, even local fire departments.
Hmm.
And they work through the ICS qualification system, and there's a certification for every level, for every position on that team. And you get to be an ICT-1. That's pretty heavy stuff. You don't get there without probably 20, 30 years of extensive firefighting response.
Interesting. So they're almost always dealing with a fire on land that maybe they don't know.
Correct.
in an area that is so this whole thing, why don't
they use local people? Well, you know what? On the district I worked on, I have 250 people working there, and no one qualified at the Type 1 level.
Just moving around that much resource,
but
and
you don't have that expertise in one place.
Yeah, that's a tricky deal.
Yeah. You may have had some of the lower graded positions, but certainly not a command position on that local unit.
Yeah, you had put on your list of things today that the differences in jurisdictions of fire agency. I think we kind of did that.
The only thing we didn't talk about is I mentioned unified command, and that's when a fire may cross a boundary from one jurisdiction to another. When you look at the state of California, there's a statewide memorandum of understanding between the federal agencies and the state.
Oh.
And what that does is it defines who has initial attack responsibility. Initial attack is first call comes into 911. There's a response. Who responds? So it goes like in Yreka, it goes through the Yreka Interagency Command Center there, and then it's triaged out to where it is on the landscape. If it's within the jurisdiction or the boundary driven by surrounded by CAL FIRE, CAL FIRE is the primary.
So what if it's in Yellowstone?
No, same sort of thing. Yellowstone, it would be the Park Service.
Okay.
You know, if it's on National Forest, there's some National Forest that's actually CAL FIRE protected.
Interesting.
They're usually urban interface areas.
So people live there.
Yeah. Other things at risk. Sorry. Other things at risk. So you have lightning fire comes through and it's on public land, Forest Service. Guess what? Forest Service gets the first call. And then CAL FIRE comes in as the backup. When you go into a command structure, triggering a team, which is by definition you've escaped initial attack. In other words, you can't contain it. With the resources on hand, and you have to go to a different command structure to be able to get at this thing.
Because they think it's going to get big, or does it have to get big first?
It already kind of got big. Or it looks like it's going there.
Okay.
And they know, they can pretty much tell by the terrain and the size and what's going to happen in the next
movement
hour.
Movement of the fire, things that are at risk. You're 24 hours into fighting this fire, and you got nothing left to throw at it, and everybody's falling out. They need some rest.
Right.
You know, that kind of a thing.
Well, that's the thing with these fires today is they, from the time they start, 20 minutes into it, they burn so fast and move so quick. I was up south of here. A fire started up above Oroville a couple weeks ago, and I was driving down highway, I guess that would be 99, and I saw a little wisp of smoke coming out of the tree line. Mm-hmm. It was up, 2,000-3,000 feet, and I knew right then, that's not supposed to be there. And within about 10 minutes, it looked like an A-bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how fast it moved.
Yeah, and that's a condition of the continuing drought.
Right.
Know? Yeah. But like I say, if you have multiple jurisdictions involved, and you also have volunteer fire departments and city departments in this too, where they have defined geographic areas. And when you get multiples involved, then you're escalating your team type, so to speak.
Right, because you have to have somebody who can deploy all of that resource.
Fire going across state line has to be a Type 1 team because they're the only ones that operate in interstate.
Interesting.
You drop down to a Type 2, lower complexity. The team's about 40 individuals instead of 55. But the rule of thumb, when I retired 5 years ago, Type 1 team will run you in the neighborhood of $1 million a day. They can push $2 million a day.
And does that take into account like all the water trucks and this and the that and the other?
Yeah, that's everything.
$1 million a day?
$1 million a day.
So for all those people who, you're still getting, you live someplace, say in the east, our friends in Philadelphia and New Jersey and stuff, and they're hearing, fire's still burning in California. It's a little blip on the news.
Yeah.
Boom, you just burned $1 million.
Yeah.
God, that's just
again,
amazing.
Or you just burn $50 million, depending on how far into this thing you are. Yeah, Type 2 team, million dollars a day, and then downward from there. But those are rough averages. A Type 1 team rarely is going to be at $500,000 a day.
Because you wouldn't have a Type 1 team if it wasn't a huge incident.
If it wasn't a big event with a lot of complexity and a lot of structures and people at risk and those kinds of things. Yeah.
interesting. And so you had put in there, is that you had put on our list, is there a public role, current law and community protection planning, like fire safe councils and
definitely.
All that? So
yeah, definitely.
So where does that all fit?
Well, there's...
obviously fits before the fire, right?
And during.
Really?
Yeah. Before the fire, certainly in working with the local agency to do fuels projects and those kinds of things that... You know, I used to describe them as I wanted to paint a picture on the landscape that no one could ignore when the fire team gets here so that they didn't have options.
Right.
Because it's the options that,
right.
you know, that somebody from afar comes in that either makes a mistake on or makes a real mess out of sometimes.
Right.
So, you know, that's where you work with your agency in doing that work. And then, of course, the protection around your home as well needs to be done before. Now, I can tell you, countless times I've been on fires where the bulk of the firefighting was done taking care of work that the homeowner should have done. And so what does that do? Everybody gripes they're not putting the fire out. Well, why aren't they? Because they're doing the work you should have done before they got there.
They're running mm-hmm. around your property
That's right.
trying to cut down stuff.
That's right.
Well, and they're not doing it like an arborist either. I mean, it's like...
No.
No, it's a massive
That's right.
removal
you
at that point.
That's right. But the point is there are only so many hands you can put on a fire. Mm-hmm. And you'd be better off putting them at productive use rather than doing things that you're neglecting doing yourself.
Mm-hmm. But they also say, you know, they used to say protect your, you know, keep it clear 30 feet from your house or 30 feet from your property line or whatever. Now they're saying 100 feet, but if you've ever been around those fires, 100 feet is nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
When a fire goes through, I mean, I saw a fire jump 299 in about 3 seconds, and that's several hundred feet across, and it went across that like nothing.
And everybody asks me this question. I got asked constantly last year, how much is enough? How much is enough? I said, well, you know, part of that is what do you feel comfortable with? But the other is, I say, when I drive through my neighborhood, I want my house to be the one that has the welcome mat out and the big neon sign saying, this is the place for your crew to be.
To park. You're not going to get burned up here.
That's right.
That's a great point.
That's right.
That is
a good
point.
Lots of open room here.
Yes.
Park your engines right
here.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and then during the fire itself, you know, the big complaint too is they don't know where things are. That and the other thing. Well, the fire safe councils have a community liaison program. And part of that program is to stay in touch with the operations side of the command structure that comes in to brief them on local things of importance.
Which roads are open,
which
are under
are
construction,
which water can you use,
there
how do you
go.
Get to the water, you know,
yeah,
all those things. Who's elderly can't get out of their house? Who's mobile, who's not, who's likely not to go and be belligerent. Those kinds of things are really important to the team.
And we hit that 20-minute
break again?
That 20-minute weird pause where no one says anything.
Oh.
We do have to take a really quick break. And, fire response technology and escalating costs. I just saw that was our last thing, but we've been hitting that right straight along, and it is escalating.
Yes.
In a grisly way. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. Went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns. The ring of fire.
Love the Ring of Fire. Just the song, not the real Ring of Fire. All right, so last 20 minutes or so, I should draw people's attention to the site, wethepeopleradio.us, and we've got like 6 different questions, I think, on here that you answered for the local newspaper up in your area. Things like, have decades of fire suppression on forest lands contributed to a greater risk of catastrophic fire? That was one that has a very long answer. With that in mind, how does fire play a role in forest health? What kinds of fuel treatment would alleviate issues of overcrowded forest? And it kind of goes into all these things, and you did really comprehensive answers. Yeah, you're never stingy with your answers.
Yeah, the paper didn't print any of it, so.
Well, see, now they can read it. But really, the answers are really good. Looking at the current state of forests, what statements would you make about how we move forward? So it's not all just life sucks and then you die. I mean, there's like some nice ideas on where we can go.
There's some hope if you educate yourself and do smart things.
Yeah, and see, the thing is, you know, I guess for some people they'd be thinking, well, this is kind of a West Coast issue. This is a rural land issue. No, it's everybody's issue. It's costing every taxpayer a ton of money.
Yeah.
Your public lands are not being managed because the budget is going to fight fire. You're going to have a serious lack of wood product in the future, which means costs are going to go way up. You're paying for the rural areas that aren't being able to support themselves. So you have counties that are 70% public land. They used to harvest timber, and that would pay for the schools and whatnot because you didn't have property taxes.
And that's how the government set the system up for rural counties to replace their tax base because there's so much public land.
But now they have to pay, secure rural schools, which is...
Yeah,
I mean, winds up being what the legislature sometimes considers as like rural county welfare.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the, and that's pretty much a welfare payment, basically, that doesn't have a kind of a trickle-down effect in the economy. The difference between that is you spend $1 for secure rural schools funding and you pay some bills, you may get $2 for one spent. In the timber industry, you get between 5 and 15 for every dollar invested.
Sure, because you had people that worked.
That's right.
That created and had jobs and were productive.
And then you have people that support that industry as well.
Well, then you also have other, it's like a mushroom cloud, because all those communities now where you've put people out of work, you're not using a renewable resource, you're not creating paper product, timber product, other wood product, so it's not funneling into your schools. You have people that aren't working, so you have higher incidence of alcoholism, drug abuse, child abuse, divorce, all those social ills that come with it. Well, the public pays for that, too.
Sure.
So you have all these things that are impacted by this across the country. And if all of the people, if you just look at Congress and you look at the number of members of Congress that represent rural areas, if those guys all voted to change this, it would never happen.
No, it's not enough.
Because there aren't enough of them. You need the folks who live in the city to talk to their legislators about this. You have to care about this.
Well, you know, some food for thought, too, is that annually the federal agencies have to do a calculation of carbon emissions associated with forest fires and other activities on the public lands. And it's not widely publicized, but in 2006... last one that I was involved with, which was a rather significant event here in the North State, Redding North, where we had, 22,000 lightning strikes in 48 hours or something like that.
Yeah, it was something like that.
The calculation for that year's carbon emissions was equal to 3.5 years' worth of the full emissions for every auto in California.
Yeah. And that was a question in the chat room. What kind of they calculated the CO2 emissions from forest fires?
I mean, if you want to look at the green side of this from the carbon carbon and climate change discussion, we are doing exactly the opposite of what we should be doing with forests by burning them up. If we highly manage them, we would sequester far more carbon. And for the first time last year, I read a national article that declared the public lands to be a net carbon loss for the first time ever to the environment.
How much of our country is in public land? Do you know?
I don't know offhand. You know, our county's 63%. There are counties on the East Coast, actually, one I worked on in Florida that was 97.
97%
public land?
Public land, yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah, I mean, there are blocks on the East Coast, but they're fairly rare. And, you know, this whole thing with this, what I worry about, and I didn't bring this up, and that's why I wanted to make sure we worked this in, was that everybody's gets all wrapped around this current fire thing. Well, I worry about my children, my grandchildren, and their children from the standpoint that when we don't reforest these areas, they're forever fallow. And we've just taken large chunks of land, like 250,000 acres of a national forest in last year fire. We're not going to reforest it. It's not going to be productive. It's not going to have the recreational amenities that people
but
enjoy.
But that's a controversial position, because they claim that it will naturally reforest.
Well, it will, but who's going to live to see it?
Exactly.
If it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't a, longer, you know, a catastrophic fire that sterilized everything in the ground.
Yeah, I know that I can have something that looks like a forest. We may argue whether or not it functions as a forest from a total ecosystem standpoint. In 50 years, I can do that with regeneration and management. It's going to take Mother Nature 300 years to do that, and I'm not making this up. This is in the science.
But, you know, and the other thing to consider is in that 300-year period, especially at the front end now, think about it. If we actually got the kind of rain we need, I'm sorry, where does all the soil go? To the bottom.
In the ocean.
Into the rivers.
The other thing to consider, too, there's something in fire science called fire residency. Or fire, and what it is that residency may not be the term, but it's when you burn something from forest to something that's equivalent to starting over with grass and brush, you establish a system that may have more frequent recurring fire on it until it finally climbs its way out of that. Because you seriously altered the ecosystem there, both in the microclimate associated with that particular site to be able to grow trees to begin with, and then you're setting it up to periodic fire in the future. I worry more without the salvage work and the reforestation on close to where I live about the fire that will occur in 20 years than I do about a little bit of reforestation work to happen right now. And the main reason I do is because when that starts to fall over in the brush, it's inoperable. So then you have to drop back and do remote firefighting, which is the highest expense of the least amount of effectiveness. And you end up burning towns that way. It's just an unconscionable thought in my mind, knowing what I know.
That's not management. It's not planning. It isn't well thought out. And it's no science.
It's just crazy theory.
Just absolute foolishness.
Yeah.
And that's being advocated. I mean, you said you were out on the burn with a bunch of environmental guys, and they thought that was just wonderful.
They got their heads around it. That, you know, this is just gorgeous. Well, you know, I think that's that was politics. That wasn't any kind of reasoned thought associated with it. And I don't believe the general city dweller or the general occasional person who visits the forest understand that extreme perspective that's driving public land management policy.
No, and it's really easy to think, well, we've cut everything. You know, you see these things, you know, we don't have any more trees.
Yeah.
Please, for God's sake, we have the technology. Get on Google Earth.
Yeah.
If you think that we've clear-cut the world, get on Google Earth and just do a little flyover of the West Coast. We have got trees to burn, as they say.
Truthfully, you want to see our impacts as a society in America associated with timber? Go look at Canada. You know, Canada does not have the regulation that we do here that protect and regrow our forests. And guess where we get our wood?
Mm-hmm. Canada.
You know, is that responsible from a global perspective? I don't think so.
No.
No, well, and it's not necessary. It's a renewable resource.
Right. If we quit burning it up.
If we just quit wasting it.
Yeah,
it's funny. You know, if we did that with, if we made tons and tons of paper and then we took all those reams of paper out and we had an agency that piled them up in their parking lot and burned them up, people would go crazy. You know, that's wasting.
Yeah.
They want them to recycle the paper at the copy machine.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, how many trees?
I remind you that's a wood product too, by the way.
Well, that's what I'm. That's what I'm saying. I mean, they're busy recycling, you know, copy paper. Oh, you see at the bottom of these emails that I print. Yeah. I always print them when it says, "Please be kind to the environment and do not print this email." I'm like, I'm going to print five of those and then I'm going to throw them away. It's frustrating.
Yeah.
Because we're burning it up at a rate you can't even fathom how much paper it is. One more quick break. dang, we're the breakingest group. It's the same number as normal, but it just seems like a lot today.
I think the enviros are still convinced that computers are going to save us paper.
Yeah, that's worked out well.
Yeah.
Government level, I know that's been a tremendous success. We'll be right back. WeThePeopleRadio.us. Tons of information there today. Go ahead and print it all out, too, by the way, and give copies to your friends.
Growing up, you don't see the writing on the wall.
No kidding, the video. We're watching the video on Bob's screen. It's like the only thing scarier than the words is the video. Yowza.
The crazy world of Arthur Brown.
Well, heavy on the crazy there. But it was appropriate,
insane,
nonetheless. All right, so let's see. You also are the science chair on the board of directors for the Wildfire Institute.
Correct.
Do tell.
What we do is we review policy coming out of the Forest Service and other land management agencies and write appropriate reviews back to the agency. And then, I feed that forward to my congressman's office.
Good thinking.
You know. And what we're about is not thinking that we'd ever eliminate fire from the forest, but we're looking for to get a balance of reasonable management back in the forest to offset the catastrophic loss that we're seeing. That's uncharacteristic from looking back through history at the fire behavior we're seeing.
Because everything we're seeing now is super reactionary.
Yeah.
I mean, none of this is actually, you know, but it is kind of interesting. I don't have it at my fingertips, but there was a letter written by a guy, Payne Ranch, in January of last year, and he had said, if they don't do something on the land, on this 13,000 acres, I believe, they will have this, mm-hmm. And as the end result, and absolutely everything on his list happened.
Yeah, so what we have is, you know, in on our board, the work on this, we have some, you know, members in Washington State, Oregon, and California, and some are past Forest Service employees from the chief's office. Some are regional directors of fire and aviation for the agency. We have currently a Type 1 incident commander works with us, and then a kind of a Northern California leader in fire safe councils. So we look at it from different perspectives. My role is to interpret the fire behavior and the science and the forest science pieces associated with either forest productivity, wildlife habitat, other issues that may arise, water, and those kinds of things.
Are they really listening? I mean,
They listen.
You do real science, and then you hand it off, and then does it circular file, or did they just run up against a brick wall when they tried to do it?
We have some luck. I mean, we you know, sometimes it causes the agency to relook at things. We saw that with kind of a rebuttal of the chief's fire policy a year ago, in about a 5-page brief that we wrote back to the agency at that, and then they did some revision associated with that.
Hmm. Well, that's good. Yeah. Okay, so how do we reach the maybe the not crazy environmental thing, the people who just don't get it? Because they just don't have the information, besides putting out information like this.
You know, I really struggle with that. What we're trying to do is, most of our board members are my age, and we're trying to find someone who's good at Facebook and some of the other more social media to do a better outreach. And truthfully, you know, most people just aren't engaged in this until they visit their favorite place on a national forest and there's no longer trees.
And there's nothing there.
There's nothing there.
They get there and go, wow, when did this happen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just for folks to understand this this program, actually, if you go to the website at wethepeopleradio.us, you have a Twitter link, you have a Facebook link, you have every other link you could possibly think of. It's got stuff I actually don't even mess with, but whatever link you'd like, send the show out. You know, ask people, engage them.
Yeah.
What do they think about it? You can email it. If they don't want to listen, there's plenty on the page to read.
Yeah, this is really important.
It affects
our lives. It affects our health.
And it's not going away.
Yeah.
It's not going away.
Yeah.
We appreciate your expertise.
Yeah, Ray, thanks for coming on again. We appreciate it.
And we appreciate you coming all the way down here.
Lots of information.
No, thanks.
Tons more fun when you're actually here.
Thanks for having me.
Bob, thanks for all the cool music.
For those of you in Philadelphia, it's like driving down here from New York City.
That's true. We should give some frame of reference. We're not next door, but we have no traffic, so
yeah,
it's a nice drive.
I don't have to take the train.
Exactly. There's that, too. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Another great episode of We the People. Thanks for joining us. Join us online anytime, wethepeopleradio.us.